Hello and welcome to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. As Russia's military operation in Ukraine enters the second month, a popular media parlor game has come into existence. Let's call it Who's Winning and Who's Losing. Sadly, there isn't much time or interest in how to end the conflict. In the meantime, Ukraine's fate is being decided. Crosstalking the conflict in Ukraine, I'm joined by my guest, Nikolai Petro, in Kingston. He is a professor of political science at the University of Rhode Island. In Delmar, we have Scott Ritter. He is a former intelligence officer and a United Nations weapons inspector. And in Brussels, we cross to Gilbert Doctaro. He is an independent political analyst and historian. All right, gentlemen, crosstalk rules in effect. That means you can jump in anytime you want, and I always appreciate it. Let's go to Nikolai first. Nikolai, I mean, it's very interesting watching the who's winning and who's losing a game on cable TV, a plethora of articles always in the main broadsheets, but there seems to be preciously little interest in how to end the conflict. That doesn't mean to say that things aren't going on. There's a format in Belarus, in Istanbul. I'm covering it watching it very, very carefully here. But it doesn't seem to get a whole lot of play. And all it takes is Secretary of State Blinken and say, "Well, we don't think the Russians are serious," and then there's no discussion any further. How do you see this here? Because there seems to be many elements in the media and in the political classes in the West that actually want to see this war to continue. Go ahead, Nikolai.
Oh, well, there are those who argue it's in America's geostrategic interest to prolong this war, to turn it into a Russian second Afghanistan or Vietnam or something like that. All of these views overlook the devastation that's occurring in Ukraine itself and the damage also that is being done to the Russian economy and to the economies of Europe in general. And I think there is indeed probably some strategy involved. Biden keeps alluding to it in confusing and mysterious ways about a new world order. Hopefully, the parameters of this new world order will become clearer to us mere mortals soon.
Yeah, well, I think that new world order is going to be some very thick lines, okay, of separation. Scott, how do you see this? I mean, you know something about the military. I'm not interested in who's winning and who's losing. I'm interested in seeing the conflict resolved with as few deaths as possible on both sides here. But it really does disturb me the kind of glee that, you know, you throw in the graphics and, there's a counteroffensive and all this. The way my sources tell me, there's actually very little resistance from the army, Ukrainian army itself. It's these neo-Nazi battalions that are fighting to the death. Go ahead, Scott.
Well, I don't know. I mean, it's clear to me that there's a significant military operation taking place in Ukraine that involves heavy fighting on both sides.
Okay.
What I can say is this. The United States has said that there have been multiple efforts by senior military officials here in the United States to reach out and contact their counterparts in Russia, but that the phones aren't being answered, which should tell you everything you need to know about the gravitas that should be attached to this ongoing Western information warfare operation being waged by both Western mainstream media and the United States and NATO. You know, propaganda is propaganda. If it's target, you know, right now it appears that Western propaganda is targeted for three targets. One being the civilians here at home to generate outrage because our outrage will then help fuel political resolve on the part of American politicians who will pressure their European counterparts to engage in very stringent economic sanctions and the revitalization of NATO. Then there's also the effort to bolster Ukrainian spirits, to let them believe that maybe they're doing better than they can. And the third one, of course, is to influence Russian domestic political opinion in an effort to create pressure from within Russia on the Russian government to alter their behavior in Ukraine. The only one that counts as far as Russia is concerned is the third one. And one, I don't believe there is massive unrest in Russia.
It's just not working. All three of the points you mentioned are utter failures here. You know, Gilbert, one of the things I find very curious in looking at these negotiation formats, it's all about the future of Ukraine's external security relations. What is absent is the internal makeup of Ukraine. And I think nobody really wants to go there, particularly in Ukraine. And the Americans and the British and other members of NATO don't want to go there either, because what's happening, the more these talks are the clock has run out, the more, and I'm just speaking more myself, I see a partition going on here. And if we don't get this conflict resolved sooner rather than later, then it'll be a de facto partition. Gilbert, your thoughts?
I think it'll be resolved later rather than sooner.
Okay.
Later being in a time perspective of 2 or 3 weeks. The Russians have achieved very important territorial gains in the territories which they, where they concentrated their efforts and where they had the Donetsk militia joined them from the north, and they came up from the south. They surrounded Mariupol. They took essentially the whole of the Sea of Azov, literal. That is that has great strategic importance and great economic importance for Russia. However this war ends, that will remain forever with Russia. Now they are turning around and addressing the issue which with which they started the war, which is to secure the Donetsk and Luhansk oblasts, as they were called, republics as they're called today, and members, constitutive elements of the Russian Federation, as they surely will be in a matter of months. Now, what was missing here is territory. The Luhansk Republic now has under its control 93% of the territory that was once the Luhansk Oblast. That is to say, its status before the war began in 2014. Unfortunately, Donetsk is in a different situation. In Donetsk, the authorities control only 50% of the land that was once the oblast of Donetsk. And the obstacle there, what prevented them from achieving similar success to Luhansk, is that most of the 100,000 soldiers that Ukraine concentrated on the Dnieper River in its initial plans to overrun these republics, and they would have done that had the Russians not intervened, that force is still there. Now, what we're about to see is the Russians redirecting their firepower and coming up from the rear, striking at those 100,000 Ukrainian soldiers.
So, Gilbert, this is the second stage, what we heard. We heard earlier that the first stage of the operation is over. Let me go back to Nikolai. I mean, looking at, you know, the failure tour of President Biden to Europe, I mean, that was a sight to see. But, you know, people say they were gaffes, but I think he told the truth every single time. This is not even about Ukraine. It's about regime change in Russia. That's what I gleaned from what he had to say. Gilbert, I'm sorry, Nikolai, go ahead.
Well, he just laid bare his thinking inadvertently. I mean, we've all followed Biden's career for many years. He's actually co-authored an article on relations with Russia, Russia's future. And it's all been very clear from the beginning that he is no friend of Russia. And it's therefore not surprising that his professions of understanding and care for the Russian people fall on deaf ears. So nothing surprising there.
Nikolai, I mean, you have like Victoria Nuland. She was in the Obama administration. I mean, she is really the godmother of the Maidan, losing Crimea, losing the Donbass, and now she's back, okay? And I've always argued that Victoria Nuland, when she gets her claws into Ukraine, it just gets smaller and smaller. It's not really about Joe Biden. It's about a mindset in the foreign policy elite. Nikolai.
Yes, and that mindset is not going away. And I think it's obviously one of the things that eventually drove Putin to this kind of reaction, which is not to justify the reaction. I am one of those who continue to hope that there could have been some sort of negotiation. I think that prior to this invasion, Russia actually had the diplomatic upper hand by arguing, pointing to the fact that the Western intelligence agencies were predicting invasion, but that none had happened. Now I think the shoe's on the a little bit on the other foot, and it's making the case for Russia being an aggressor, unfortunately, that much easier in the West. And that's another hurdle to overcome in reaching a consensus.
That's a good point. But Scott, Russia was always the aggressor, irrespective of what it does, if it invaded or didn't invade it. I mean, I agree with Nikolai on a rhetorical level. But I mean, this is a godsend for people like Victoria Nuland because they have so much more work to do. Go ahead. We have 1 minute before we go to the break. Go ahead, Scott.
I don't think Russia cares about Victoria Nuland. I don't think Russia cares. I don't think they care about Biden or anybody. Russia's going to do what Russia's going to do to resolve its own security problems. And they're in Ukraine right now doing just that. And I think Ukraine will unfold on a timetable that's dictated by Moscow, not by Brussels, not by Washington, D.C., not by CNN.
Well, that's very interesting because the way I've looked at the coverage of it, I mean, and the way the media elites and political elites, this is their story. It really is very divorced from the events going on the ground. And I tend to agree with Scott. You know, Moscow's going to do what it's going to do. When it's done, it's going to say it's done. On that point, gentlemen, we're going to go to a short break. And after that short break, we'll continue our discussion on the conflict in Ukraine. Stay with RT. Welcome back to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. To remind you, we're discussing the conflict in Ukraine. Okay, let's go back to Gilbert in Brussels. Gilbert, what kind of Ukraine is going to come out of this? You know, we had the coup in 2014. The Crimea voted to leave. Donbass separated itself from Kyiv. We're looking at military operation, Russia's military operation now. It will lose its access to the sea, most definitely, and there's nothing anyone can do about that. So what kind of Ukraine is there going to be? Is it going to be a rump state, you know, with Galician ideology and all of that? I mean, is that something that the EU wants? Does anybody want that? Go ahead, Gilbert.
Well, rump state might be a misnomer, because we're speaking about republics in the Donbas and the territory to the south that has been conquered in the last 4 weeks fighting, giving the Russians control over the whole Azov Sea littoral. That's maybe 15% of the territory of Ukraine, and it isn't a much greater percentage of the population before the war. So what remains to be seen is whether there will be a genuine partition between the eastern part of what remains of Ukraine, which has a fairly high percentage of, or had before this war, a high percentage of Russian speakers and people who identify themselves as Russian ethnically, and the western side of the Dnieper, which has a considerably higher percentage of people who consider themselves to be Ukrainian speakers. That remains a possibility, but I think it's unlikely. Now, who will take control of Kyiv? That depends on the weeks ahead. What will be the results? The Russians declared from the beginning they want a denazification and demilitarization. Now, that may be a nice objective in negotiations, but I think it's a still more effective objective in action on the ground. The Russians declared today that they have destroyed 90% or more of the Ukrainian military production. If they succeed in smashing the 100,000 Ukrainian army that is parked on the left bank, on the west of the Dnieper, then they will effectively both denazify and demilitarize Ukraine. Whatever one wants to put down on a piece of paper that Mr. Zelensky will sign before he runs away or is hanged.
Okay, before he runs away, that's an interesting way of putting it. Nikolai, who's going to determine the outcome of this conflict here? And what would be a fair outcome, okay? Make yourself a neutral observer. What would be fair at the end of the day? I want to keep our viewers in mind with, you know, thinking about 8 years of war in the Donbass, which the West took no interest in whatsoever. You know, that is very, very important. The West doesn't recognize the Crimea referendum, but certainly the Crimeans do. So at this stage here, what would be fair? Or is that impossible to answer? Go ahead.
I'm not sure that we can talk in terms of fairness now. That'll have to be determined over more than our lifetimes, I think, depending on interpretations. I'd like to say a few words, literally single words, about the kind of Ukraine that we're going to see after military actions are over. We will no doubt have a more nationalistic Ukraine, a weaker Ukraine, a more illiberal Ukraine. We're already seeing the manifestations of this in the arrest of more or less every opposition figure in Ukraine. And of course, a more resentful Ukraine for this generation, at least.
Well, will there be resentment against the West as well?
Yes.
Yes.
Yes. And the best lesson, I think, that thoughtful Ukrainian elites can take out of this is to be more reliant on their own interests and think about their own interests first as independent actors.
Well, you're saying the quiet part out loud, because, Scott, that was going to be my question to do. Who is the decision maker here? Because, you know, if Zelensky runs away, I mean, is he a free agent? Is he a person that can actually make a decision, in your opinion, Scott?
Well, the Russians certainly hope he is, because all of these finalities that people expect out of this conflict, for instance, Ukrainian recognition that Crimea is Russia, Ukrainian recognition that the former oblasts of Lugansk and Donetsk are now independent of Ukraine, perhaps expanded to include Mariupol and other areas around the Azov littoral. This can only happen in a way that can be accepted by the West if Zelensky signs on to it. You know, he has been elevated to a Winston Churchill-like heroic figure, and the West has articulated that it is up to him to dictate the terms of peace. So, you know, Zelensky, of course, has a lot of pressure. If he surrenders too fast, he might get hung by the right-wing nationalists. If he drags this thing on, the West is going to be a little bit more reticent about providing, you know, military support that simply gets blown up or captured by the Russians. So there's a balancing act. But at the end of the day, Zelensky is the only authority in Ukraine that can provide legitimacy to a Russian victory. And there will be a Russian victory. So it's in Russia's best interest, I believe, to keep Zelensky empowered, to keep him viable, and to keep him alive, so that this surrender can be eventually negotiated.
Nikolai, you want to jump in there?
I had a word.
Go ahead.
About Russian victory. I agree. Everything on the that we can see on the map and in the cards points to a Russian victory, partly because they've hardly deployed sufficient forces, but I mean, they have fewer people there, and they have much greater resources available to them to carry this thing out to a successful conclusion. But the point is, and this happened at the end of the last negotiations in Istanbul, what if Russia loses heart? What if the negotiating team is given orders to prepare, you know, some sort of agreement without fulfilling the military objectives and the political objectives stated? There could be a tremendous backlash, as there was right after the end of the announcement in Istanbul that some sort of major progress had been made. This was not met well in Russian society.
Yeah, I actually we did a program on that, and I thought it focused on external matters. It didn't talk about internal, and that's what I found really kind of odd because it was only half the story here. Gilbert, let me kind of change gears with here. What is the future of NATO? Because NATO failed to keep the peace. And for all the propaganda that comes out of that organization, there's not a whole lot of unity. And I think it's only going to get worse here. I think NATO and its drive to drive Russia out of Europe forever has actually come up empty-handed. Gilbert, go ahead.
Well, a judgment on that really depends on whom you're talking to. If you're speaking to people in Western Europe, they're all saying, hurrah. NATO has never been so united, and just look what we have undertaken. If you're speaking to outside observers, and I include myself and I think your other panelists in that community, then the situation is very different. Russia has taken a beating. I mean, NATO has taken a beating in terms of prestige, in terms of its viability as an alliance that can pretend that it can protect its members. The states that consider themselves frontline states, like the Baltic states, like Poland, I think they all have to take notice that the United States is standing back and has offered only a material aid to Ukraine. A lot of it, by the way, equipment coming out of storage and not necessarily usable. But the United States has in every way indicated that it will not act to help Ukraine keep its borders, keep its sovereignty, and so forth, even to the extent, and as far as I understand, the United States has specifically said it will not stand as a guarantor of Ukrainian sovereignty under the terms of any peace agreement that may be concluded. But if I may just switch back a moment to the question of Mr. Zelensky, I'm not so sure it's so simple. I'm not so sure that his maintaining his position is in Russia's interests. I'm not so sure that concluding a peace treaty is in Russia's interests. It really makes no difference. It is force that speaks here. And I think any European power that would like to go in again to Ukraine after this is over would be out of its mind. So Ukraine's future, whether ratified by a peace treaty, not ratified by a peace treaty, will be the same. As regards the successor to Mr. Zelensky, he will be a very ugly personality. And the real ugliness of the Kievan regime will be clear. And whoever succeeds Zelensky. Zelensky is an actor. Zelensky has been fed all of his lines by the best of U.S. PR firms. And Zelensky is a great information war deficit for Russia. So if he's gone, so much better.
Scott, the thing that I look at is I look at a lot of these negotiations of just being bluster, because I tend to agree with what you've said on this program, is that political facts on the ground will determine the outcome here. And, you know, you can have all the talk you want, but at the end of the day, what did Stalin say? He said, how many divisions does the Pope have? Go ahead, Scott.
No, that's absolutely true. You know, we are prisoners to the information we have.
Yeah.
Right now, the West is very effective at flooding the battlefield, so to speak, in this information war with data that projects one image. Russia has not been so effective in countering that. And I think that's because Russia simply doesn't care. Russia isn't involved in information war. Russia's involved in real war. And, you know, hopefully for the sake of Russia, that war is progressing along the lines that are acceptable to the political leadership and the military, can accomplish this. I do agree that if Russia stops short, fails to achieve effective denazification. And I will tell you this, if the next leader of Ukraine is a prisoner to the far right and is as ugly as the gentleman speaks of, then Russia lost this war, because denazification isn't just the physical destruction of Azov, Donbass, and the other national battalions. Denazification is the liquidation of the ideology of Stepan Bandera that resides in Lvov. And unless Russia takes care of that, They haven't denazified anything. So I think this military campaign is going to be broader in scope than many people think.
Having to have to fight that ideology in this century as well. Who would have thought? That's all the time we have, gentlemen. Many thanks to my guests in Kingston, Delmar, and in Brussels. And thanks to our viewers for watching us here at RT. See you next time. And remember, crosstalk rules.